brand actually does affect everything too. I can tell that our internal culture is more fun now than it was when I first started, because like people kind of, they're the people who are drawn to our content are the kinds who apply to us. So they're internal and they, you know, they feed it, right? So that's just like a little nuance I wanted to add.
All right, folks, we're excited to have another conversation, not just around helping people get into a place where we understand brand, but we understand people. And one of those people that I've actually looked up to recently on LinkedIn, kind of talking around this space, not just in the realm of brand, but in the realm of like actually talking to people as a company, is a new follow and potential friend of mine. We haven't established that yet, but I've got with me today, Mr. Nick Gaudio. Nick, welcome to this conversation.
Well, thank you, Luke. And we are on the path to friendship.
We're just on the brink. We can't go there yet.
Yeah. Cordiality, I think, is where we're at.
There we go. Yeah.
But you're in Austin, right? So
we're both in Austin. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, it'll happen eventually. We'll go get some coffee or something. And
There we go. It's the Austin way. Right. Now I give you this kind of grand red carpet rollout, Nick, because yeah. I mentioned you, I look up to you as a writer and an author in many ways. I know you have a history there. Mm-hmm. But currently you're the head of brand at a kind of growing quickly startup called Rattle. Mm-hmm. We'll start there. What has been your path in the brand of Rattle individually? And then I want to kind of go the path of how do you see the brand overall of Rattle? How do you see their growth really?
Sure.
So let's start with you.
So, I guess my story starts, I was hired, I moved down to Austin like 10 years ago, actually. Mm-hmm. On a lark. I didn't have any money. I got a really crappy apartment. I had like a Murphy table, a Murphy bed, and a mini fridge. I always joke that like my
Austin dream.
Yeah, my bed had a handle, but my fridge didn't. Is the joke. But so I had a couple hundred dollars in my name, and I was like, you know, just here on a dream.
Yeah,
I kind of complained at this tech job. Like a forum that I couldn't get an interview, and somebody said, stop trying to be humble about this and like make a big splash. So I ended up going, I had been in a newspaper before that, and I called in a favor and said, I'm going to need you guys to run me off some newspapers. And I made a joke resume and I walked into the Chive, which at the time was sort of like the big media publisher.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that the CEO had gotten his wisdom teeth out that day, and he was looped out of his mind, and he loved it very much. And he actually didn't remember hiring me at that like on the spot. I went in.
Oh my gosh!
But they're like, yeah, you like this guy. And I still, you know, I was like, well, I already put in my, I was working at like a gas station or something. And
yeah.
Like, you know, so I got on there as a low level copywriter and, I just sort of started looking around for things to do and, you know, give myself some value. It wasn't a great paying job. Mm-hmm. I did like all of our e-com stuff. And one thing that I actually learned from the Chive was actually like, we were basically just stealing content from Reddit. And I was like, why are people coming here? Right. Like it doesn't make a lot of sense. And it really was apparent that like brand was everything. Like brand was the reason that they were, you know, in the top 30 websites on the internet, and why people, you know, Keep Calm and Chive On was hot at the time. It was like everywhere, you know.
Is this pre Chive TV?
Yes. Pre Chive TV.
Okay.
I was there when Chive TV rolled out and all that kind of stuff. I basically worked my way up. I went from like low level copywriter to head of email, to head of email and push, to head writer.
And
before I left, and then I still had a Saturday, and for years I had a Saturday column where I had a pseudonym, because I'm also a serious writer on the side, and I don't really like the politics of the Chive was a little, and it still is a little complicated. And, I noticed that the importance of, you know, developing a community around this shared vision, that kind of stuff that, I've reused and repurposed in other jobs. I ended up leaving there for the tech world because, you know, the media bubble burst and it just seemed like it was time to get the hell out. I worked at a company called Rev, which was a transcription company. One of the first in the AI space. We actually, what I did was went in there. They had this about page where it's like, we made this company to make money, and it was like, that's not a good like vision statement. Like, you know, it's like, do you want to go to? Like, I remember going in the room with the CEO and being like, do you want to go to a pizza shop where the guy says, I created this to make money? Or
yeah,
with the guy who says, I'm passionate about pepperoni or whatever, right? So he let me rewrite the brand story, and that's where it really started. And I did some wacky stuff for them in all the like campaigns that we ran. Like, there was this one where I ended up calling out Hall & Oates and made like a Hall & Oates joke. It's kind of a running career thing where I've made one with Rattle as well. But their agent was on the email list and was like, we can get them to play for you. And then we did, and it was just a wild internet connection thing.
Unreal.
I had a really good time there. And I got kind of like B2B famous for that, I guess you'd say, where I would get people emailing me like, hey, who's this person writing these emails? Who's these people writing these ads? Mm-hmm. And then I was just like me. And then I went off and I started my own company because of that. My wife got pregnant, and then we had a ton of kids. We have 3 kids, and and she's a lawyer, so she's gone all the time. So I ended up trying to get another like regular 40-hour week job.
But that's
sort of where it all started. And I think that you can kind of see little mm-hmm. pieces of that where the turning point for me at rev.com was we had actually been covered. It was a little startup, and we were covered by the New York Times as this exploitive thing where we were getting humans to translate things. Like, it was a translation and transcription company. And they're like, you know, they're exploiting people just like Uber. And we're like 80 people deep here. Like, we work in a house. Like, this isn't, there's no office. It's a rented out house. So, the first challenge I really faced when I was at Rev, was, how to re-ingratiate ourselves with our email list. And all these people who had written back, like, oh, I saw this thing on New York Times that you're exploiting these transcriptionists and things like that. And then thinking, okay, well, what can I do? It was just around Christmas time, so we ended up running this really fun Christmas campaign where I acted like people were asking for a Rev gift card, and it's like, well, don't get your nephews and nieces the gift of transcription for Christmas; they won't like it. And it ended up going off and like doing like B2B viral, and that was sort of the first taste of like introducing personality in the brand and you know, in a tech world, because it's, you know, the Chive was B2C, right? And it had this, you know, Playboy-esque quality to it, and they wanted, that's what they wanted. And I was like, well, what if we reappropriated that kind of thing in a tech world? And then people were just like, wow, this is refreshing, because it's not falling in the same thing. So those both of those principles are sort of like have gotten me where I'm at now, and I think you can kind of, you'll see it in the stuff that we're putting out for Rattle and you know, anything else I kind of put my hands on.
Yeah, it's powerful. So your own personal journey in brand leads you kind of from wild writer, gas station wild writer to not just understanding writing, but helping companies kind of generate the narrative of which they're perceived in the world, right? Which of course is the story of brand, but this is still, you know, even 2024, this is semi-new in the realm of, you know, like the past 2 decades or so. You know, you could leave out kind of Silicon Valley in that process too, but with your journey into tech, you know, tech really is the space that has kind of just been like product focused mainly for as long as we know it. I mean, we're still sort of in this new tech age. And so when you come into Rattle, where they're really doing RevOps, coming from kind of this Chive background, what did you see as sort of like your main objective coming into a company that is, you know, growing at the speed that Rattle's growing?
Well, I mean, they weren't whenever I was first starting. I hopped in because I liked the product, honestly. Like, I saw it. I was like, I hate Salesforce a lot. And I, like, knowing that you can get kind of like stop, like, we call it I started the tagline. I get to write tagline. So, but we call it the GPS for GTM. It's like turn by turn directions that you don't have to, you know, it's like, do this right now in your Slack, you answer it, right? So there's my pitch for Rattle. But anyway, like, I love the product. And I was like, this is great. And then we got into the back, and I got on, and the first thing I did was like, where was our own presence, right? So I looked at our email list. It wasn't really very, very robust. Some of it was purchased, some of it was, you know, partner based and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, I just don't think this is the best place to build from. We had about 2,000 people on our LinkedIn, a little bit under, 1,800 or so. And I decided that was the best place to get the exposure that I wanted, right? You have to pour the top of the funnel, right? So that's where I decided to take over. Of course, some of the stuff that I started posting at first didn't get the leadership buy-in that I wanted. So I had to kind of slowly boil the frog, you know what I mean, in the water, where I was like, I'm just going to do this little thing that's a little off, and then
show
them, you know, this
is gonna work. I am curious about that process, because we do, and this is maybe one of the things I'm most fascinated about you, is that the tech world is a lot of like bankers, investors,
right,
and board members, and then, you know, a founder who has to answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of legal jargon that you have to jump through, stereotypically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you approach that fight? You're sort of saying, okay, I fragmented pieces of like the crazy or the you know, wild brand and built it up.
Yeah.
What were those early conversations like to, I guess, convince leadership buy-in? Because you and I both know, and far as brand goes, without leadership buy-in, internal culture, like, you can do whatever you want externally, but internal culture is never going to change.
Yeah, and I think that it's so funny, because brand actually does affect everything too. Like I can tell that our internal culture is more fun now than it was when I first started, because like they're the people who are drawn to our content are the kinds who apply to us. So they're internal and they feed it. Right. So that's just like a little nuance I wanted to add to having that first conversation though. I mean, my CEO would be like, delete that. And I'm like, okay. And then eventually I was just like, look, and then I just kept doing it and doing it and doing it. And then just like I said, it's frog in water. I'd say, you know, eventually, I remember the moment that it ended up working for us was one of our investors had texted our CEO and said, I love what you're doing on LinkedIn. And I was sort of like, I mean, give me carte blanche. Weirder and weirder stuff. But like, you know, I did have a conversation with my CEO, and I said, look, you know, I was a head writer for a website that used to get 30 million unique hits a month. I got us up to the number one comedy app store on the app store. You're going to have to trust me, man. Like, I know what I'm doing. And, but at first it was definitely like some of the weirder stuff that I was doing. They were, you know, the stuff that I was doing that I'm doing now, basically, was stuff that they're just like, we don't feel comfortable with that.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, you just gotta earn their trust, right? Like, it's their baby. And you have to sort of just play it slow and break rules here and there. And, you know, I do ascribe to the ask for forgiveness, not permission.
Yeah.
To a certain point, like, you can also kind of play it dumb and say, I didn't know, or something like that. But the one thing about that Rev campaign that I mentioned was my bosses were out of town. I ran that. Not to say that that's like the only thing that you can do, but sometimes, you know, they have to see it happen and then they realize the world is ending.
Right.
After you do it. Right. So,
There's a lot of fear around. I mean, gosh, we're just a day post Super Bowl 58, and everybody and their mom is posting about something that happened.
Right.
But we can look at the commercials and I don't know about you, and maybe you even wrote, I think you did write about it today, that there's sort of a lack of creativity in this year's commercials. And there is this sense of like fear among people who are spending that much money. And typically, again, it's probably investors or board members driving that, that, oh my gosh, if we, no pun intended here, rattle the cages a little too much, someone's going to say they hate us. And then that's no longer good press.
Right.
What's your take on that? Because as far as I understand it, and from what you're talking about, brand should take a side on some level.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You can't, especially when you're in this early stage like us where you want attention. I do think there's such a thing as bad press, but I think that they have sort of not gotten the point of those commercials, right? The point is to be memorable, I think, right? Like, and if everyone's doing the same thing, if everyone's, you know, getting an A-list actor and having them play themselves, and then there's like, you know, a little, you know, some little meta joke about their, you know, in the past, or some nostalgic joke, whatever. Like, no one's gonna remember. I honestly have a tough time, like, you know, pulling apart who, what famous, you know, with who, right? And it seems like there's a, there is that, right? There is this, there is a, this worry, maybe more so now than in the past, where you don't want to go viral for the wrong reasons, or you don't want to pull Bud Light, right? And piss off half the country or something like that by in some way or some other way, right? So I think that, you know, we do live in that kind of world, but there's definitely ways to be funny and memorable. I mean, I'm making RevOps funny. I made transcription funny. Like, you can do it. Right. Yeah. And it doesn't always have to be funny. Like, I really think, and it doesn't even have to be high budget. Like, I really, one of the things that, one of the commercials I really liked was Disney's, where it was just like words on the screen, where it was just like the iconic,
yes,
that was just like, you know, it was playing heavily in nostalgia and all the kind of stuff, but they were taking a, risk and being oversimplified. And in order to get attention, you have to take risks. Right.
Yeah.
So calculated risks, but risks all the same. Mm-hmm. And, what I saw was, 50% budget for the spot, 49.99999% budget for the actors, and 0.0001% for the writing, right? And
it's wild.
Yeah, and that just doesn't, you know, like, I love Christopher Walken, but I can't remember what product he was selling.
No, right.
Christopher Walken, there's only one, whatever.
Yeah.
Right, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and the perspective here, just to think about for people maybe who aren't in brand or aspiring to be in brand, I mean, you just think about a book or a movie. If we spent more money on who's going to be in the movie and the marketing behind or the ad dollars behind it, most people aren't going to, like, the movie's going to flop, you know? And we've seen this happen. High budget actors, they try to go get some dollars in opening weekend. Right. And then, like, you go in and everyone's kind of frustrated about it.
Right.
But you're, in many ways, you know, you're pulling this kind of into the tech world more and more. You know, you talked about taking risks. One of the, I don't know, cooler risks I see Rattle and your journey taking from kind of the start. I mean, there's a handful of other tech companies kind of following suit now, or at least in tandem, you know, pursuing more brand culture focused things, not just the ping pong tables in, you know, at their offices anymore, right? A brand that follows culture. Talk to me about the decision behind and the process behind Sir Ding-a-Lot and what that means to kind of the Rattle brand.
Yeah, I mean, so honestly, Sir Ding predates me. I was, you know, they had the branding that they had. In fact, that was one of the reasons that I took the job. It was both that I liked the product, but I saw that the marketing team was gesturing towards these things, and they kind of knew what they were doing, but they weren't quite there yet. And understanding, like, the reason that Sir Ding is who, like, what I use is that I wanted this. We have a team of go-to-market professionals, right? And we're selling to go-to-market. And I thought, what is the best way of talking to them? And it's tapping your nose at them and saying all these meta jokes and making him as a mascot into this sort of meta mascot, right? Like, so when we do things, we're always doing this, like, heightened version of them. It's and it lends itself to the comedy of using him too.
Yeah.
Like, our audience understands that I'm doing that with a little, like, tongue-in-cheek, like, backhand to it, right? So it's like, it just shows that we know what we're doing, right? So we write a lot of meta emails where it's like, you know, I realize I'm just an SDR reaching out to you, big shot, you know, CRO, right?
Yeah.
And understanding these things because we're in that world. So that's another, like, fun part of being here, was that I'm marketing to the people who appreciate these things. I actually, that's why I liked Rev too, because a lot of our audience were marketers. So they would write back, like, I'm a email marketer, and this was a fantastic email. And that's one of those really, you know, prideful moments for me, where I was like, when real experts know that we're, like, making these subtle gestures to what their culture, what they know, what they're worried about. And it's a good way to build trust. So, and it also affords all sorts of fun stuff too. I was like, you know, I get to dress them up in all sorts of things, because there's all these tropes in that ecosystem of having a mascot that you get to play around with. And it keeps us from ever having to, you know, dig. And, you know, that's one of the hardest things about B2B is just coming up with new content that isn't boring as hell all the time. Right.
Yeah.
And, one of the things that I had, I said I was in newspapers before, but I was in small town news, and that's a different problem. It's very similar to B2B in that you have to fill pages and you have very little. Like, I remember like running on my home, you know, I was the editor. So there was a duck that was stabbed in a pond, and that was like eight, the H1 for the day. Like, found stabbed in pond. It's like,
yeah.
Sometimes you just got to run the duck filled stab and pawn thing, right? Like, or, you know, here's a puppy nursing kittens and stuff like that. That happens in news, in the small town news all the time. So finding a way that, you know, brand can carry you through that boring part where, you know, if you're having trouble coming up with something, you can always lean back into this thing that kind of proves that, you know, what you're talking about, proves the problem, that kind of thing. So,
It's a powerful, one of the things, and I love what you're talking about, because to me, when I think about, I mean, I'm in brand, so I know it's connected to everything, but oftentimes it feels like we've got to convince other departments that it matters just as much, or it's not just marketing.
Yeah.
Talk to me about your position in that, because you did kind of come from this marketing background, but you're radically influencing culture as well as other departments. And let alone the fact that you're speaking now to people in RevOps, or you were speaking to people in marketing before. So just talk to me about that shift, because I think that is one of the brand activation internally is just, I think it's radically important as well.
Yeah. And it's one of those things too, that luckily in B2B that, you know, you get 10 likes on something and that's viral, right? Like, you don't need it to be, you know, 500,000 people sharing it. B2B has this lovely quality of, you know, working in small quantities, right? So, there's part of that, but also I'm like one of my biggest cheerleaders internally. And I know that's probably obnoxious to like a lot, especially when they come in new, but when people mention,
you gotta respect Snoop.
Right. Exactly. Like he, you know, like I, whenever somebody says I love the brand and I see it online, they mention us, I screen cap it and I throw it in the marketing channel and say, hey, look, you know, it's out there working. Or I hear, listen to a Gong call and somebody says, I just love your content to our, you know, sales reps. They get it to the point where they won't even tell me anymore. They get too big. But like, I'll see it and I'll say, you know, look, this, you know, grease the wheel, this big contract we ended up getting, right? Like you have to constantly point back to your ROI, but it's one of those things too, that when you're doing it well and doing it really well, like you'll eventually get over that hump and it'll be kind of a predetermined success, right? Like you don't have to keep continually proving it, even though I'd still like to, you know, do that. I think that once you get the momentum rolling, once you're able to start saying, hey, look, you know, our competition's not, you know, I have all of our competition on LinkedIn does this really well, where I'll say, you know, your LinkedIn, your competition got 200 new likes and we're getting 1,000 a month or whatever, right? Like, you know, you can just say, look, you know, we're absolutely trouncing these people. We're taking up tons and tons of share of voice. Like, you know, it just makes it a lot easier. And then you get included in other things, right? Like I'm actually, I had one of our first meetings with product today where they're like, hey, can you come into in behind the sign up and edit something?
That's powerful.
Yeah. But you know, they would have never done that in my first couple months here. They're risk averse, and that's largely risk averse as product people, right? But your job as a marketer, especially when you're on the brand side, is, you know, to build that audience and make sure that their affinity is high, right? And you do that through being charming and nice and human. And I think, like I said, the meta stuff really helps us. You know, that's really where we shine, is that we're constantly making these little jokes and like about the culture of go-to-market, and that really makes people feel like they're understood. Now, if we understand that, we understand their problems, and then therefore we understand their solutions, right? So that was the calculated guess there.
That's powerful. I'm curious for you, you know, just thinking about other branders, other marketers, as we just sort of wrap up this quick conversation.
Sure.
Where do you want to push sort of the limits of brand for, especially in the tech and SaaS space? I think it's just a very it's an ever-involving space. Everyone wants to keep pushing things like AI. And I mean, there's always things going to be evolving, and we're going to see a lot of copycats and bad writing. And so where are you trying to take it? What's your hopes with it, considering Rattle or just other organizations?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that AI is going to make things a lot harder on people who don't put effort into brand and to humanize their brand. And I mean that like as a counterbalance to AI, like humanize in a way that makes it apparent that humans are behind it. You know, we're if not already there, but there's a tidal wave of mediocrity coming, right? And if not, I think we're probably reaching there now, right? And that means SEO content's going to be like that. That means social content like that. Every channel is going to be gummed up with garbage. I think that the events world, the meet spaces, they call it, like, that's going to blow up because people want to interact with other people. They don't. And I think that once it becomes more apparent that AI is able to like be hyper optimized to manipulate us into doing things, people are going to be far more skeptical of those things. So Rattle is luckily in a great position now that everyone knows that, well, everyone knows it's me, but they also know it's just a human. I almost think sometimes like it's not that I do this intentionally, but I leave typos. Like if I have them, I'm like, you know, it just seems like it's clear that it's somebody there. Right. And it's not, I don't, you know, it's one of those things where I don't think anybody looks at what we're doing and saying, oh, there's an AI there. And there's no one that would possibly, you know, guess that that would be a human. I think that, or that would be an AI, but I think that, you know, the capabilities are going to get better. And when that happens, it's going to make these channels like really, it's, you know, standing out is going to be really, really hard because it'll be more and more difficult to tell. In fact, I think you saw recently, I just like called out that SDR from some company who was like, that's fascinating. And then just like did that AI response to me. And I was like, this is terrible. And please stop doing that. Like it's insulting. And I say, I think we're all in the agreement here in sales and marketing that people don't mind being sold to. Whenever you say, do you like being sold to? And 95% of people say, I don't like being sold to. That's not what they don't want to be manipulated and they don't want to be inconvenienced. They want solutions to their problems, right? So if you're manipulating them with AI or inconveniencing them with AI by, you know, make them read this whole long paragraph or whatever, like they're going to hate you, right? And I think that there will be this balance. And I'm not, I'm an AI fanboy big time. Like it's part of my workflow. But I humanize everything, right? Like it gives me the structure. Sometimes it helps me with jokes. Sometimes it helps me like with frameworks and things like that. But ultimately at the end of the day, it's me who's, you know, going through every line and making sure that it's human and all that kind of stuff. So that's what I think is the best, you know, way to think of brand for coming forward is how are you going to make it interesting, believable and memorable in an AI world. Right. And that's through humanizing it.
You know. I guess, you know, just kind of finally off of that, you are a head of brand that is very public, I would say, with the work that you're doing.
Sure.
And so, I mean, is it of your position that or stance that like, hey, more heads of brand should be out here kind of preaching their own story or do you like, is it possible for them not to create their own personal brand around it? Should someone in the company do it? Should it be the CEO? Like, do you have an opinion on that?
Your mileage may vary, right? Like, I think that, you know, and I do it because I'm kind of neurotic and I just like good stuff, right? Like I'm tired of, and I will almost always I'll even go with a more expensive option of things when I like the brand. I think there's people who are that way, right? Like there's there's a gas station company that I'm in from the Northeast that I like their stuff and I'll go out of my way to get gas at their company, you know, whenever they have very kitschy market. It's called Sheetz. They add a Z to everything in their marketing. It's just funny. And I just find it charming. So if I see a Sheetz 3 miles and even if their gas is more expensive, I'll go there. Cause I'm just like, I feel heard or part of that community or part. And there's some weird tribalism there, but to do it for your own self. Yeah. I mean, I recommend it if you're drawn and driven to that. I'm not talking about Rattle's brand I love their brand. I love the company. I love the product. But I'm talking about it because that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the negotiation of breaking rules and, you know, how narrative plays into things, how community plays into things, and all that kind of working, that philosophical stuff behind marketing that really, that kind of, that gasses me up. So that's why I talk about it, because I want other writers to, you know, talk to me, other brand people to talk to me.
Just to finish it off, you talked about Disney earlier. You're repping a Pooh Bear mug right now, which right. people could see or not see. I ask everyone pre-interview, what's your favorite Disney movie? And the reason I ask this question is because for me, and it's funny you bring that ad up, it's nostalgic storytelling for me. It is. Hate them or love them in some of the decisions they've made, whatever. They're nostalgic storytelling, and there's a seed planted in there for me. Yeah. I asked for your favorite Disney movie. What did you say?
I think I said The Lion King.
The Lion King. Give me just like the highlight reason. Why is The Lion King up there for you?
It's a retelling of Shakespeare's Hamlet with lions. And
with lions.
And the soundtrack's, you know, bumping, you know?
It is.
Cinematata.
It is.
You know?
Oh, man.
And my kids, I mean, I have three. So we've been, and my wife is a Disney mom. Like, she wants to go to Disney World every year. We don't
love
every
it.
Year, but we've gone twice. Yeah. Now with kids, which is intense. And that's why everything in my house is Disney. So I've I forgot that I even had this. So, but
it's just a part of you.
Yeah. So, but on the rewatch value is really high. I think that's
it. It is. Us brands can learn a lot about the Disney old school. I think the 90s movies for sure. The new movies, it varies. But those 90 movies, you know,
I've seen Tangled to the point now where I probably could recite the entire thing by heart.
Yeah.
That's every night is Tangled.
I love it. Nick Gaudio, I am so grateful for you in the world of brand, the world of marketing, the world of just future shift in tech. Where can people get connected and follow along with you?
On LinkedIn, baby. That's it. I'm on.
Bada bing.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Luke.
Appreciate it. I love it. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man.